crisis around global civil society right now. We can't solve all the other problems if people are being spied on willy-nilly like this.
We want to thank you so much, Ronald Deibert, director of the Citizen Lab at the University of Toronto and author of Reset, Reclaiming the Internet for Civil Society. We're going to do part two of the conversation, and we're going to post online at democracynow.org. How do you protect yourself? And a very happy birthday to Sam Alkoff. That does it for our show, Democracy Now!, produced with Renee Fels, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Tarasena, Tammy Warren, of Trina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamaria Studio, John Hamilton, Rabbi Karen, Hani Masood, Adriana Contreras. Special thanks to Julie Crosby. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. Due to the temporary closure of in-station activity at KBOO, meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing, unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available on our website. The Finance Committee meets on the third Thursday of the month at 5 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify if a meeting is being held.
Tune in to KBOO on Thursday, September 16th for KBOO's Board of Directors Candidate Forum from 5:30 to 6:30 p.m. Hear from candidates Ashley Matthews, Todd Kimball, and Charles Chambry about why they want to be elected to KBOO's Board of Directors. Again, that's KBOO's Board of Directors On-Air Candidate Forum on Thursday, September 16th from 5:30 to 6:30 p.m. here on your community radio station. More information can be found at kboo.fm/meeting2021.
Democracy is an experiment, and so is community radio. During this fall membership drive, KBOO will take a deep dive into democracy in all its forms, from current events to music programs. KBOO is your community connection. We're non-commercial and independent. We're supported by our members, so show your support by becoming a member of KBOO today. Go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. You can also mail a donation to KBOO at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97214.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on this special International Day of Democracy edition of the KBOO Evening News, Portland City Council strikes down vote on trade ban with Texas. California Governor Gavin Newsom survives recall election. And in international news, the World Health Organization condemns wealthy countries for administering COVID booster shots. Good evening, this is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, September 15th, 2021. I'm Ethan Sandweiss. Yesterday, the Oregon Health Service counted 2,040 new cases of COVID-19, a slight decline from Oregon's most recent peak in late August. Nonetheless, transmission rates remain high. Halfway through the month, September already ranks as Oregon's fifth deadliest so far. 44 people died yesterday from the virus, including one victim as young as 24. Of over 1,000 hospitalized, 288 patients were in ICU beds. The vast majority of hospitalizations and deaths are among the unvaccinated. An average of 7,403 vaccine doses were administered each day last week. According to the Oregon Values and Beliefs Center, one in five Oregonians still don't plan on getting vaccinated. With 74% of Oregon adults at least partially inoculated, vaccination rates are seeing a sharp decline. Nationally, one in 500 Americans has died from the virus. Portland City Council backtracked on a vote to ban interstate commerce with Texas. The proposed ban was a response to Texas's new strict anti-abortion law, which prohibits abortions after the sixth week of pregnancy, before most people know they're pregnant. The council purportedly reconsidered its vote due to questions over implementation. The city council instead voted to donate $200,000 to unspecified reproductive health care groups. The resolution also declares city council support for abortion rights and opposition to Texas's ban. The new resolution has the support of four of five council members, with the sole exception of Mingus Maps. Maps spokesperson Adam Leon said last night, "This resolution is out of step with what Portlanders are asking us to do." Portland is ground zero for a nationwide strike at the Nabisco Corporation, protesting changes to worker contracts that could cost thousands their benefits. After more than a month of picketing, tensions are growing at the Portland plant. Private security employed by Mondelez, Nabisco's parent corporation, have become increasingly violent, in one instance pinning a protester to a truck, and in another elbowing and stomping on their feet. The security guards belong to the Detroit-based Huffmaster security firm. Mondelez has held out on union demands, but Nabisco is starting to see a decline in business. Undelivered Mondelez orders have increased since the strike began, and production has dropped precipitously at the Portland plant. The Nabisco strike is one of several ongoing high-profile strikes across the USA, including struggles at Frito-Lay, Amazon, and at coal mines in Alabama. After a contentious Republican-led recall election, Gavin Newsom will remain the governor of California. Californians voted nearly 2-1 in opposition to the recall. Newsom said he was, quote, "humbled and grateful to the millions and millions of Californians that exercised their fundamental right to vote and expressed themselves by overwhelmingly rejecting the division." Newsom's main opponent was right-wing radio personality Larry Elder, a voter fraud conspiracy theorist and close ally of former President Donald Trump. Although Elder received less than 30% of the vote for preferred candidate, he could have still assumed the position of governor if the motion to recall were passed. Elder and Trump alleged even before the election that voter fraud had been detected. Newsom's term lasts just one more year, and he's expected to have no strong challengers in the Democratic primaries. While recall petitions are common in California, only one other has ever gone to a statewide vote, when Republican Arnold Schwarzenegger ousted Democrat Gray Davis in 2003. With more on the recall election and other stories, it's Suzanne Potter with 2021 Talks.
Welcome to 2021 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times. California's recall election went off smoothly despite fires, false allegations of fraud, and the ongoing and exacerbated challenges of voting during a pandemic. Governor Gavin Newsom bested 46 candidates, including his top challenger, conservative radio host and avid Trump supporter Larry Elder. Governor Newsom is expected to run for a second term. His current term ends in January 2023.
No one has been turned away from being able to vote, and we believe that every Californian who wanted to vote has had an opportunity to do so.
California Secretary of State Shirley Weber told the New York Times there were no lines at polling places to speak of. Phones were answered throughout the entire process, and ballots were sent to everyone, including those in fire zones. Voting should be easier, according to Congresswoman Amy Klobuchar. She joined several other Democrats to introduce the Freedom to Vote Act on Tuesday, which she says expands access to the ballot.
It makes sure that people can vote regardless of their zip code in the way that they want to vote that's safe. And finally, it includes really important provisions to stop gerrymandering.
The bill sets national standards for early voting, allows all voters to request a mail-in ballot, and makes Election Day a national holiday.
This is a moment when our democracy picks itself up, brushes off the dust, and moves forward as America always does, going forward as a nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
All 50 Senate Democrats are now on board with the watered-down legislation. Majority Leader Chuck Schumer plans to hold a vote next week. For the first time since taking office, President Biden's approval ratings have dropped into negative territory. According to a new Quinnipiac University poll, 42% of Americans approved of Biden's overall performance, while 50% disapproved. Biden's ratings on issues like COVID-19 are about even. However, on foreign policy, just 34% approve, compared to 44% prior to the U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan. Today, President Biden stopped by the National Renewable Energy Laboratory Flatirons campus outside of Denver, where he said, "We can't wait any longer to take action on climate change, and that means promoting renewables like solar and wind."
"We don't have a lot of time. We don't have much more than 10 years, for real. And this is a decisive decade. Already the price of solar generation in this country has dropped 80% over the past decade. And today, renewables are now cheaper than fossil fuels in many parts of the country."
The president added, "Nearly one in three Americans live in communities that have been struck by a weather disaster in just the past few months." I'm Suzanne Potter for Pacifica Network and Public News Service.
September is Hunger Action Month, and Oregon's network of food banks is reminding people that the pandemic has hit many families hard and will continue into winter. Eric Tegedoff has more on the story.
Groups fighting hunger and poverty in Oregon are urging renewed action this month to ensure everyone is fed. September is Hunger Action Month across the country. Oregon Food Bank is holding its State of Hunger Address virtually this Friday, which is also Hunger Action Day. Susanna Morgan, who heads Oregon Food Bank, says the pandemic has been hard on many families, and recovery could be slow.
Hunger nearly doubled in Oregon and Southwest Washington, and it would have been worse weren't for federal stimulus efforts. Stimulus checks directly to people, or additional unemployment benefits, or additional benefits through SNAP, moratoriums on evictions and foreclosures.
Morgan points out many of these federal policies are expiring, causing worry that more people could experience greater food insecurity heading into the winter months. Oregon Food Bank's network of pantries and partners across the state and in Southwest Washington reached more than 1.7 million people over the past year. Morgan notes hunger was an issue before the pandemic, and some communities, including neighborhoods of color and immigrant communities, face disproportionate impacts from food insecurity. She encourages people to get involved this month.
This is Hunger Action Month, right? It's not Hunger Awareness Month. And so what we are hoping is that every person in the community will take some action, whatever action is in your heart.
Morgan says there are many ways for folks to take that action, whether it's donating food or money, volunteering at a local food pantry, or writing to their elected officials. Oregon Food Bank's State of Hunger Address begins at 10:45 a.m. on Friday. For Oregon News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
House Democrats proposed a top 25% federal tax rate on capital gains and dividends for the wealthiest Americans. Compared to President Biden's proposed 39.6% top rate, the proposal is a generous concession to the ultra-wealthy, who receive a higher percentage of their income from investments versus wages than middle-income earners or even the upper-middle class. Additionally, Biden proposed increasing the corporate tax rate to 28%, still well under pre-2017 levels, and possibly raising the minimum tax on foreign earnings past 20%. If the bill is passed, the IRS will also receive $80 billion over the next decade to enforce compliance among high earners. The proposed tax hikes on Americans earning more than $400,000 per year would raise an estimated $1 trillion. Combined with other tax measures, that amount could reach nearly $3 trillion. Biden and other progressive Democrats hope that a higher capital gains tax on top earners could help foot the bill for their ambitious $3.5 trillion economic package, which largely provides for social welfare and climate change initiatives. But the package needs the support of all 50 Democratic senators to pass, and conservative senators such as West Virginia's Joe Manchin and Arizona's Kristen Sinema have drawn out negotiations. No Republicans are expected to support the measure. A new report finds county jails across Pennsylvania are inconsistent and vague in terms of their procedures to help people who are incarcerated vote in elections. Here's Emily Scott.
Many Pennsylvania county jails don't have clear policies to support voting access for people in jails, according to a new report that says this inconsistency leaves some eligible voters in the dark. The groups All Voting is Local, Common Cause Pennsylvania, and Committee of 70 filed right-to-know requests with 61 county jails, asking for their voting procedures for people incarcerated. They learned there's no universal plan for providing information on voter registration or getting ballots to the 25,000 people in county jails. Ariane Abney with All Voting is Local says without any processes in place, it leaves those prospective voters disenfranchised.
You're basically telling the person in jail, it's your own responsibility. It's up to you to know who to call to even ask for a voter registration form. When you don't do that, you have a whole segment of the voting block that may not even know that they have the right to cast a ballot.
Of the 46 county jails that responded, 57% had no written policy on jail voting. The report also found in the entire state jail population, only 52 people requested mail-in ballots in the 2020 general election at 18 of the county jails. The report suggests maintaining relationships with county election officials and providing voter registration opportunities are pathways forward for county jails. Abney says helping people in jail determine their voting eligibility can have a major impact even after they're released.
We really see this as an opportunity to create positive voting experiences for people who are in jail. And there are long-term benefits to that happening. When they have positive experiences with voting, they tend to vote again in the future.
The report also recommends making mail-in ballot applications readily available. Abney says he'd like to see some of these solutions in place for the November election. I'm Emily Scott with Keystone State News Connection.
You're listening to a special International Day of Democracy edition of the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for KBOO News in Depth, where we'll be taking a look back at democratic actions in our community over the past year. Our celebration of the International Day of Democracy continues until 7 p.m. At 6, it's Sprouts, Electoral Integrity in the U.S. At 6:30, it's Free Culture Radio, Nothing About Us, Without Us. Then at 7, it's Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather is cool, dropping down to the mid-40s in the early morning. Tomorrow's weather is in the 60s and 70s, clouding up in the afternoon and evening. Today in history, Charles Darwin's ship, the HMS Beagle, arrived in the Galapagos. His trip was pivotal in forming his theory of evolution. The quote of the day is from Charles Darwin. "I've tried lately to read Shakespeare and found it so intolerably dull that it nauseated me." Virginia is one of the top states for distributing federal rental assistance amid the pandemic. Emily Scott has more on the story.
Virginia has distributed a larger share of the rental funds it received than any other state in the country, and housing advocates want to see the state continue the trend with more protections for renters. Since January, Virginia has distributed over $300 million of its $524 million from the Federal Emergency Rental Assistance Program. Christy Mara of the Virginia Poverty Law Center says that's due in part to Virginia being one of the first states to set up a rental assistance program in June 2020 through the CARES Act.
Nothing helps as much as having a rental assistance program so that when people lose their jobs, when people have an unexpected expense, they have somewhere to turn to fill the gap and to pay their rent. No change in the law is going to do that except having this fund continue.
Virginians in need of help paying rent can determine their eligibility and apply online on the state's Department of Housing and Community Development website. Mara and other advocates suggest it took being shamed for Virginia to become a national model for rental assistance. A 2018 report from Princeton University's Eviction Lab found 5 of the 10 largest cities with the highest eviction rates in the country are in Virginia. Since then, the state has enacted more safeguards for renters. Catherine Howell of the RVA Eviction Lab says it's a good start, but more can be done.
Investment in counsel, and in fact even a right to counsel, I think could be a really powerful way of making sure those tenants who have rights and know how to exercise them. Because it really is hard as a tenant to know all the things. They're not experts in housing law. They're not experts in understanding eviction and what rights they have.
Virginia is receiving an additional $465 million in rental assistance through the American Rescue Plan. I'm Emily Scott with Virginia News Connection.
The World Health Organization is urging wealthy nations to stop administering booster shots and start sharing vaccines more widely with the developing world. World Health Organization Director General Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus said that providing third doses in wealthy nations, while much of the Global South struggles to provide first doses, is really not right. Many African countries have vaccination rates under 2%, well short of the modest 10% goal set by the organization. While wealthy nations have pledged to donate millions of doses, developing nations have had difficulty buying doses, largely because of export restrictions that include vaccines under the umbrella category of finished products. According to Strieve Masiyiwa, Special Envoy to the African Union for COVID-19, lifting these trade restrictions is even more important than lifting the restrictions imposed by intellectual property laws. India, one of the world's largest vaccine-producing nations, may consider resuming exports following a complete ban in April due to the country's own soaring case counts and death rates. Advocates for clean energy are applauding new initiatives signed into law by Governor Kathy Hochul to combat carbon emissions, which scientists say are a major catalyst for extreme weather, sea level rise, and health risks. With more, here's Michaela Savitt.
Clean energy groups are touting new zero emissions vehicle initiatives in New York, part of the state's ongoing effort to reduce the greenhouse gases that scientists say are primarily responsible for global warming. The new act establishes that new passenger cars and light trucks sold in New York must be zero emission by 2035. Medium and heavy-duty vehicles must follow suit by 2045. While the goal is ambitious, Deb Peck Kelleher with Alliance for Clean Energy New York says it can be reached with added sale locations, among other initiatives.
A lot of vehicles in those next 14 years will age out and need to be replaced. If we put in a number of pieces behind the goal to make sure that consumers can go to their dealership and can purchase the vehicle that they want locally, I think that we'll get there a lot quicker.
A bill in the New York legislature also would expand the number of retail locations that can sell all electric vehicles. Other proposals would create incentives for school districts to purchase electric buses and allow state sales tax exemptions on the first $35,000 of a hybrid electric vehicle purchase. Governor Hochul has also directed the state DEC to release a proposed regulation similar to California's law to reduce diesel pollution. Pat Kelleher says this would most affect people who live in high-traffic areas.
The zero emission requirements in the advanced clean truck rule are crucial to public health and equity in improving air quality in these neighborhoods and ensuring access to clean transportation.
Studies show Black, Latino, and Asian American communities are disproportionately exposed to air pollution as a result of living near highways. And with more severe weather events affecting New York, Peck Kelleher adds there's been greater recognition that transitioning vehicle production from gas-powered to electric must happen.
Change is hard, and I think people are just economically looking at it to figure out where they will end up in the new electrified universe.
Under the 2019 Climate Leadership and Community Protection Act, statewide greenhouse gas emissions must be reduced to 40% of their 1990 levels by 2030. I'm Michaela Savitt for New York News Connection.
Casa Milagro is a group home in Santa Fe supporting people who have experienced houselessness and mental illness. Soon, it will be entirely solar-powered. Dr. Anthony Lizowitz has more on this story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. In Santa Fe, New Mexico, a group home called Casa Milagro provides permanent housing for people who have struggled with homelessness and mental illness.
We try to the best of our ability to be a holistic program that takes into account all of the different human needs and desires.
Executive Director Desiree Bernard says that approach includes everything from peer support groups to art programs and environmental initiatives, including a garden and rainwater harvesting. And soon, the 12-bedroom house will be powered by the sun. Community partners and donors are helping to fund a 23-kilowatt solar array at Casa Milagro. It's expected to meet all of the home's energy needs, including heating and cooling. Bernard says residents are excited.
They, I think, collectively feel a real sense of pride about it. And it feels like a lot of just good and positive energy whenever we discuss it.
She says that in addition to reducing the home's carbon pollution, going solar will drastically reduce its utility bills.
That money can just go right back into the program to support the wellness of people who have been through a lot of hardship.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
The Delta variant has been spreading quickly on the Oglala Sioux Pine Ridge Reservation. In response, the tribal nation has decided to quarantine its schools. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Schools on the Pine Ridge Reservation in South Dakota are under a quarantine order. The Oglala Sioux Tribe issued the order Tuesday, citing an increase of positive COVID-19 cases, the rise of the Delta variant, the number of students under 12 not eligible for a vaccine, and the number of homes with multi-generational families. Vice President Alicia Mosso provided an update on social media Tuesday night, saying the tribe is not on lockdown, but the order is a temporary way to try and slow the spread of COVID-19.
Please don't go to work. Please don't go to school. This is part of it. Why we're having this current school quarantine order is because a lot of these cases are in our schools. And in order for us to get ahead of the spread, in any public health emergency, you need to contact trace so we can stop the spread. Unfortunately, it's getting to be a little bit much, and there's a lot of schools, and we know they all have their plans, but we are going to work with those schools on their plans as we move forward. The tribe has had some ordinances in place for a very long time, which is some of those ordinances that I placed along with the school quarantine order, so you can reference those. We can quarantine buildings, so that is the official action that happened today.
The order was issued after 21 new cases were reported in one day. The 10-day quarantine order goes into effect Wednesday. The tribe is under orange risk while it continues with a number of COVID-19 safety guidelines for the reservation. The Globe and Mail reports federal fisheries officers in Nova Scotia, Canada, have been removed from water where Mi'kmaq fishers are harvesting lobster. The move follows confrontations last week between officers and Indigenous people. Videos of confrontations are circulating on social media. The harvest is outside of the federally regulated season. Indigenous people say it's their treaty right to live off the resources. Assembly of First Nations National Chief Roseanne Archibald is supporting Indigenous fishing communities. She traveled to the area last week and witnessed firsthand the federal enforcement actions. In a press conference streamed live by APTN National News, Archibald says First Nations sovereignty and jurisdictions need to be respected.
The AFN stands with you as you exercise your treaty rights to operate commercial lobster fisheries. Conflict is a legacy in which Canada has offered apologies and promises. It's time for these promises to be made concrete through commitments to recognize, respect, and promote First Nations rights, while at the same time providing justice for First Nations citizens who are both working within the Canadian legal framework and who are forging ahead with their own laws and processes.
Indigenous people say their traps and lobsters are being seized. There are also reports of arrests. Treaty rights and fisheries issues are being raised as the Canadian federal election takes place next week. A number of tribes and Native organizations are calling on the Biden administration to protect gray wolves. The Associated Press reports a letter was sent this week to Secretary of the Interior Deb Haaland seeking an emergency petition claiming states have become too aggressive in hunting. Tribes and organizations from the Northwest, Southwest, Great Plains, and Rocky Mountains were among those to sign the letter. Congressman Raul Grijalva recently introduced a bill to require the Department of Health and Human Services to confer with urban Indian organizations on policies and initiatives for Native people living in urban areas. The Indian Health Service is currently the only one required to confer with IOUs. The Urban Indian Health Confer Act is intended to help improve health care for American Indian and Alaska Native people living and seeking care in urban areas outside of IHS. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
You're listening to a special International Day of Democracy edition of the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, September 15th, 2021. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast is Dan Raphael. The producer is myself, Ethan Sandweiss, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Emily Scott, Michaela Savitt, Eric Tegadoff, Antonia Gonzalez, Anthony Lizowitz, and Suzanne Potter. The director of the Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Ethan Sandweiss. All of our KBOO programs, including special programming events like the International Day of Democracy, are supported by our members. If you would like to support our programming and become a member, you can go online to kboo.fm/IDD or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for a KBOO News in-depth retrospective on democracy in our community.